And I wanted to give you a very warm welcome to the first event in our practitioner series of Lent 2021. It's our first remote practitioner series, and we're delighted because it's remote, it's been a lot easier for our guest, for Deborah, to be here with us because being based in the US. And it's also possibly made it easier for many of you to show up because we've got quite a big crowd tonight. So thank you so much for coming and welcome. I'm Ella McPherson. I am one of the co-directors of the Center of Governance and Human Rights, and I want to welcome you along with my other co-director, Sharat Srinivasan, who's there, to this event. And before we get started, what I want to do is just thank Jenna Anderson, who's our coordinator, and as well as Saskia Breckenmacher, who has organized the practitioner series, for making this whole evening possible. So thank you very much for that. And then of course, I really want to extend a warm welcome and a thank you to our special guest for this evening, Deborah Brown. So I'm gonna read you a little bit of bio on Deborah and then explain a tiny bit about the series. And then Deborah and I will go into a conversation where I prepared some questions and to sort of talk about Deborah's work and career. And then we're gonna open the floor to you all for a Q&A. And I wanted to say that you can either put your hand up using the Zoom function or put a question in the chat. And if I see the question in the chat, I can read it out for you, or I can call on you if your hand's up and you can ask the question yourself. Okay, so Deborah Brown is a senior researcher and advocate on digital rights at Human Rights Watch. Her areas of focus include the role of digital technologies in electoral processes, content governance, cybersecurity, and digital exclusion. Before joining Human Rights Watch, she worked at the Association for Progressive Communications as the Global Policy Advocacy Lead, where she worked with a global network of civil society organizations on a range of human rights and internet governance issues. Deborah worked at Access Now and the United Nations Foundation. She holds an MA in Democracy and Governance from Georgetown University and a BA in Human Rights and Political Science from Barnard College, Columbia University. I also wanted to say that she, at the Association for Progressive Communications, she led the organization's work in UN processes and engaged governments and companies. So we are very happy to have Deborah with us here today because the practitioner series is kind of a special space, I think, in terms of the typical Cambridge event, which allows students and staff and members of the public to engage in conversation with a leading practitioner who is kind of at the cutting edge of new developments in the spaces of human rights and governance, in terms of understanding more from them about what their career trajectory has been like, what their field is like, and also possibly even to seek some advice on your own careers. So with that, I will turn over to my conversation with Deborah and begin by asking you, Deborah, can you please tell us a bit about your current job?
Sure. And also, I just wanted to thank you for the kind invitation. And it's really a pleasure to be here with all of you tonight or today, depending on where you are. So my current job, as Ella mentioned, is with Human Rights Watch. And I joined Human Rights Watch almost a year ago. My role is to work as a researcher and advocate on digital rights. And kind of when I'm thinking about the title, I'm not crazy about calling it digital rights because it's really about people's human rights in the digital context or in the world in which we live today where technology is increasingly pervasive. And my job is both because digital rights aren't, you know, a standalone or a siloed area. It's a lot of working with other researchers in different divisions working in different countries to help them understand or to report on and research the way that technology is impacting human rights in those countries. And then also carrying out my own research on various digital rights issues, which Ella had mentioned earlier. And then in addition to researching, I'm also carrying out some advocacy work. A lot of that is unfortunately in response to, you know, the latest development of a company or a government doing something bad, or I'm also looking for opportunities at the UN or other intergovernmental fora to push for better norms on technology issues.
That is an amazing range of work. And I'm just wondering sort of, you know, I know that pandemic days are different from sort of normal days, but in a sense, I'd be really interested to hear what the, you know, how that means for a typical day or a typical week in your job.
Sure, yeah. I don't know what's typical these days, but for me, actually, I basically started during the pandemic, so it's all the same. I think there's maybe three different things that, I'm just going to say three different things. Let's see if it ends up being three. One is the responsive and reactive work. So I might have a plan for the week, but then a government shuts down the internet, or a company, you know, takes down the account of an activist, or deplatforms the president of the United States. So there's the stuff that I have planned, and then also the reactive stuff. And for some of these issues, they're things that they might be new, but we've seen them before. So like an internet shutdown, or they're unprecedented. So like a technology company, not just the Facebooks and Twitters of the world, but the companies that are what we call further down in the stack, like the web service providers or the app stores taking an action. So sometimes we have to think on our feet, and you know, we always go back to human rights standards and what norms would provide for, and come up with new positions on issues. The other kind of longer term work is, you know, guiding my own research or trying to work out a policy position around an issue that we know is emerging or that we'll be needing to respond to. And then there's also the endless, it seems, webinars and events. And I think it's an important part, especially given that everyone's working remotely now, to be part of the broader human rights movement, to not just sit in your apartment and, you know, do your job, but actually work with others. And I think what's really challenging and exciting about digital rights is how much the field changes. And even more so, again, during the pandemic, when digital issues are more pervasive in our lives, but even generally, like, it's not a static field where, you know, you've researched it, you understand it, and now you go out in the world. Like, things are constantly changing. So I think that constant learning is a huge part of my job. And then finally, this is more than three, writing, to really be kind of out there and thinking about writing commentary or doing original research on various issues.
So I wanted to ask you, I was thinking of asking you next, sort of how you did you always know that you wanted to do this, or how did you get here? But actually, you said one thing that I wanted to ask just before that, which is, I wonder if other members of the audience are curious about this too. Like, what does an app store have to do with human rights? You mentioned something
about Okay. So the specific reference was about President Trump, or about the US, because there was an app called Parler. I think it still does exist in principle, that a lot of the people who were storming the Capitol and making plans were using to coordinate. And that app in particular didn't have content moderation, but they didn't have policies in place in order to deal with content that might incite violence or spread hate speech. And so because they didn't put those policies in place, the app stores, the Google Play Store and the Apple Store, said, you're not following the policies that we, you know, that we lay out in order to be part of the store, so we're going to kick you out. And then following that, Amazon, which hosted the servers for this app, also on a similar argument said, we're going to kick you off our platform. But this is actually, everyone's like, oh, this is a new issue, but it's actually one we've come into contact with a few times when governments, for example, put apps in stores in the app store that is using a lot of, they might force citizens or encourage citizens to download an app that will take a lot of their data, that will track them. So there's the case of other types of abusive apps being allowed in the store. So we've reached out to those companies to see if they can delete them. There was one particularly abusive one in Russia around the pandemic that I think is still in the store, but they did fix some of the policies around. And then there's another case of an app being kicked out of the store because the government doesn't want it to be there. So in Pakistan, the Ahmadiyya community has apps that they use to access the Quran and to connect with one another. And that religious group is marginalized, and I think it's actually criminalized in Pakistan. So the government's forcing the app stores to get rid of that app. And that's ongoing now. I don't know where it currently stands, but there was a hearing last week. So app stores are very relevant. They might not be so obvious, I guess, but there's a whole kind of political dynamic around them and not very much transparency.
That's really interesting and also very frightening, I guess, as a kind of, you know, one way in which power moves in here that's not so obvious. So I wanted to come back around to the question I was gonna ask you before, which was, you know, your work is so cutting edge, and I was gonna ask you, did you always know you wanted to be in this, especially because it's like, how could you predict it? How could anyone have predicted what would be happening right now in terms of human rights and technology?
Yeah, I mean, when I was in grad school, I don't even know that I knew of the field, to be honest. Like, I don't know, I think, so I finished my master's degree in 2011. And I think a lot of the attention towards the role of technology and human rights and social movements came around the Arab Spring. Of course, it was a field before, but I think that's when it kind of got forced into more mainstream media coverage. And it's actually connected to how I got interested in the issue, because I was actually studying democracy and governance and Arab studies for grad school. And I needed to pass an Arabic proficiency exam when I graduated, and I had lived in the region before. So the summer between my 2 years, I went to Syria, and that's known to be the best place to study Arabic. And I was staying there for the summer and was told, in order to access the internet, you have to use all of these circumvention technologies. So I'm like, okay, that's different. And then I actually was living for the first few weeks that I was there with someone who was a foreign correspondent, the only registered, I think, in the country. And he actually had full access to the internet, but he said, just so you know, it's not censored or filtered, but it's completely monitored. So then I understood that, okay, so for people who can access it, they're under surveillance. And for other people, they have to learn skills to circumvent that. And I started to get a sense of both the promise and the way that technology can be used to control and coerce populations. And, you know, even just whether it was combined with physical surveillance that you'd see in the streets, kind of just the way that impacts people. And then just a few months later, the uprising happened. And so kind of seeing how scared people were to speak, but how they still had that basic human desire to exercise their rights, and then the role that technology was playing in it, that made me really interested in this field. And then right after I graduated, I had a fellowship at the United Nations Foundation to look at a human rights issue of my choice for the year. And so I started looking into basically what the UN and what international standards said about the internet. And at that time, it wasn't much. That was the year that the UN Special Rapporteur on Freedom of Expression released his first report, which essentially said that freedom of expression applies online. And then a few months later, or maybe it was the next year, the UN passed its first resolution that said human rights apply online. And then from there, I think the field, at least from my perspective, it started to grow, and it probably existed before then. It definitely existed before then, but I think it grew exponentially, and there's been a lot more attention to these issues.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And it kind of gets into my next question, which is, you know, when you think about your career path, and I think this is a question that I think all of us have, is like a career path, like how much of it is, I mean, part of it was due to your experience, you became interested in this area of your work you were doing, right? And the summer visit, et cetera. But, you know, so part of it is kind of intentional and planned, and you have a direction that you want to go on. And part of it is kind of serendipitous, and you learn things when you go places, and then you end up sort of shifting slightly. So I'm wondering if you reflect back on sort of between now and when you were doing your degree and your career path, and like how much of that has been like your plan, and how much of that has been serendipity?
Yeah, I can say it was very planned. I think I really just followed sort of where opportunities and interests brought me. But I would say there were some common threads. I studied human rights in undergrad. And then my master's degree, I didn't actually end up pursuing traditional governance work, like in the sense of, you know, improving democratic institutions in countries and things like that. But I do look a lot at internet governance. And I think a lot of the work I do is looking at how technology influences government systems and what types of governance systems are needed to hold companies to account, and sort of that interplay. So I would say that I'm drawing on, you know, the education I pursued and some of the earlier jobs that I had, but that a lot of it was kind of following a path that opened up as I went. But I would say that meeting people along the way, you kind of learn, like I even now I'm seeing people in my orbit who I knew many years ago who were doing something different, but that, you know, over the years, I think the human rights community is looking more at technology. And I'm not sure if I answered the question exactly, but I think it was a bit of a combination of both.
Yeah, I think it's always reassuring to hear that, you know, careers aren't necessarily step A, B, C, and D, and that you can have opportunities that you didn't even anticipate. But also nice to know that you have people moving along with you. And so you have your networks and your friends and your work.
Yeah.
You were saying that you know, you feel that this space, the intersection of kind of human rights and technology, has really grown since the Arab Spring. And the interest in it has really grown. And I wonder if you've seen kind of changes in what the focus has been on and the interest has been on in terms of, I don't know, particular rights or particular regions or whatever might have been a shifting way in which kind of work was organized over the years between then and now. Yeah, have you seen that kind of evolution and change in your field?
For sure. And I think in a few different ways. One is, I think the original kind of framing, again, in the US at least, was around so-called internet freedom and the idea that technologies are liberating and the focus on freedom of expression. And I think that has its roots in Silicon Valley and was a political kind of statement from the US government and allies at the time. But I think now there's more of a realization that technology impacts a range of rights. And again, since we're in the pandemic, you can see, you know, education, right to health, a lot of economic, social, and cultural rights, and that technology can play a role in exacerbating inequality and isn't just this, it also can be oppressive and can, you know, advance or reinforce discriminatory outcomes. So I think the field has advanced. I hope there's more attention to those issues now, and also gender-based violence and different types of discrimination that are experienced by people who are marginalized online. So it's not, you know, just that if you get online, suddenly you can get past the gatekeepers, but that there's new forces of oppression and new forces that you have to contend with online. So I think that's one area that's changed. The other, I think, is that hasn't changed is just the need for access still. Like, I think there's this impulse to always look at the latest technology and, you know, what algorithms and AI and biometric surveillance and all these things that we need to be aware of, that those are kind of where everyone's looking or start, like the direction people are going in. But around half the world's population still doesn't have meaningful access to the internet. And that's not going to change unless it's actually something, and that's a human rights issue in itself. And I think that's something that there needs to be more attention to, and that's not going away. I think the last thing I would say is that there's more specialization now, and that it used to be that, you know, the simple statement that human rights apply online was like a big thing. And then, okay, how do they apply online? And now there's people who specifically look at, let's say, data protection or automated decision-making or social welfare systems that rely on technology. Like, there's a whole kind of world of different ways you could focus. And I don't think that was really there 10 years ago when I started.
Can you explain to us a little bit more when you mentioned that, you know, internet access is a human rights issue? Interested to hear more about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's traditionally seen as like a development or economic issue, maybe, but I think it's really a human rights issue because I don't know how you can exercise your rights fully in today's world without having access to the internet. Certainly kids can't get an education during the pandemic. You can't access social welfare benefits if you rely on them. Access to information, and this isn't as simple as getting access to the internet, because as we probably all know, there's a ton of misinformation and disinformation online. But I mean, during the pandemic, especially, like, public health information was being provided, or just even being able to access and communicate with people. I think it's really hard to see how one can fully participate in public life without access to the internet. and also thinking about people who might have disabilities or not be able to, you know, travel to a capital to or a city to get engaged in a protest. There's all sorts of activism and social movements that happen online. So I think, it's increasingly hard to see how one can exercise a full range of their rights without internet access. And people are still struggling in many ways. And it's not necessarily, in some cases it is an infrastructure issue. In some cases the connections just simply don't exist. But a lot of it is incentivized by companies who are, or lack of incentive from companies who should be providing that, that infrastructure and service.
Yeah, that's super interesting. And I also wanted to ask about another kind of evolutionary step that you talked about, which was the kind of recognition that human rights apply online. And I don't know, I guess in now that we live our lives, our public lives in a mediated fashion, it sort of, you know, that almost feels like it's a given, but I'm interested in you thinking back to the times when that was controversial. And if you remember kind of what the controversy was or what the different viewpoints were in that, I'd be interested to hear about that as well.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. I mean, one argument we heard a lot, like having done work, a lot of advocacy at the UN was, well, that's just like a rich country issue. Like we've got more important things to think about in other countries. And a lot of the countries that were saying that were ones that likes to shut down the internet or censor a lot. And I think it was more of an excuse. And I think governments started to catch on relatively early on that they could have more control and that they could use technology to coerce populations, their people, and to silence them. And so they wanted to be able to do that. So I think it was a combination of not necessarily seeing the relevance and then also seeing it as a tool that they could use. And I also just want to reflect on that online, offline dichotomy, because I think, you know, 10 years ago, that was something a lot of civil society organizations are pushing for, saying human rights apply online. But I wonder how useful it is to speak in those terms anymore. Because I think, again, it's about technology. And like if we're being exposed to facial recognition in the streets and being profiled and that's used by law enforcement, I don't necessarily feel like that was online. That was just, I was walking in a public space and technology was used that way. And so I think, our phones hold so much information about us and our tracking devices as we walk through the streets. And again, we're not necessarily online. So I do think it's a good kind of rallying call, like human rights apply online. But again, I think it's more about human rights applying in the digital age and how do we reinforce and safeguard them?
Yeah, thanks. I think that is a really good way of putting it. It's sort of, especially thinking about our lives now, right, is that we have to get rid of that dichotomy. And I'm wondering, you know, we've talked about some of these changes, but I'm wondering about, you know, what you see as the big challenges in your field. So what you think are the kind of next big problems that need to be solved?
I think one of the biggest challenges is how to contend with the power of companies and the role that they play, because they're often the intermediaries, whether it's providing access or the tools that we're using right now. And in some cases, especially in more closed environments, social media companies are the only places where you can express yourself freely, or they're at least somewhat better than, you know, going to the government in terms of how the government regulates speech. But they also have so much power, and there's a lack of accountability. And even when trying to understand what the right solution is, there's an asymmetry in information. So we can say, you know, we don't think that this decision was right by the company, but we don't have all the information that would help us identify the solution. So I think one of the biggest challenges is how to address that, how to come up with ways to hold companies accountable without reinforcing government power, and also in ways that is sensible, that is informed, and not just based on what we can formulate without the full information we need.
Yeah, that is a massive problem, actually. I'm wondering, you know, thinking of those kinds of problems, is there a kind of challenge or dilemma or kind of problem that you face in your work and you've sort of, you know, had to do a lot of maneuvering to figure out what the right course of action is?
I think it's actually related to that last question, because it's hard to ask for an activist account to be restored without talking to the big companies, or to understand, you know, why did they knock this person off or keep this one online without talking to them, understanding their policies. And in order to do that, you have to develop relations with them. You have to have calls with them. But at the same time, a big source of the problems we see is their business model, is the way that they collect our data, is the way that they control public spheres. And in order to get fixes to those smaller but still important issues, you still need to talk to them. So it's this kind of dynamic of, well, you need to have relationships, have that ongoing conversation, but they also represent a lot of the things you want to change. And I think one thing that's helped, it doesn't solve the problem, but one thing that's helped is understanding, like anyone, they're not a monolith. So the human rights contact at a company is probably your biggest ally. They're not in the power to change things, but that's one contact point that you can work with.
Yeah, again, I think that's really a good, we often talk about these companies as Facebook or as Google or whatever, but as you say, they're made up of all the different individuals with different sort of backgrounds, experiences, and worldviews. So it's about, I guess, finding your allies within there. I'm wondering if you, just reflecting a bit more on the work that you've been doing, what's the work, we're curious to know, what's the work you're most proud of in your career?
That's a hard one, I think, especially since I don't feel like where I am in my career, I could say this is like a pin in my hat, but, or feather in my hat. But I think, so I mentioned that I'd done advocacy at the UN for many years. And I think working on so many submissions and the kind of with tedious documents and, you know, editing text of resolutions and sending those to governments can feel a bit, unrewarding. And then I've seen, for example, inputs that we've provided go into UN reports, which then get cited by activists in different countries or by governments in, you know, carrying out a policy. And it's like slowly over the years, things that seemed relatively radical or envelope pushing at the time have become more mainstream. And I think, even though I just dismissed the, you know, human rights apply online, like, it wasn't easy to get there, and being part of, you know, the group of NGOs and civil society that helped articulate that and mainstream it, I think is rewarding. And then also for many years I worked with the Association for Progressive Communications, APC, which is both a NGO and a network. And the network was, I think, is still in around 30 different countries. Mostly countries in Africa, Latin America, and Asia. And just seeing, you know, once every year or so we'd get together, or I still follow their work, and seeing what we did as an organization being used in different countries and being tools for people working in really difficult environments is also quite rewarding.
Yeah, thank you for telling us about that. I'm wondering also sort of, you know, from your perspective and, you know, sort of where, you know, maybe sort of honest perspective, what's your field getting right and where is it going wrong, or how would you like it to sort of perhaps change slightly going forward?
Yeah, those are big questions. I'm trying to think of a way to respond without being too reductive, but I think one thing we're getting right is this broadening, I would say, of not just, I think understanding where digital rights fall within the human rights movement, and not just, because I think there's a tendency to look at the technology and how do we get privacy right, or how do we get this specific feature, you know, company to change this specific thing. And I think there's more awareness of where this field fits within the broader human rights movement and working with people who are fighting other human rights fights. So I think that's one thing I'm hoping we're getting better at. I think one thing we're still struggling with is, again, reckoning with the role of companies. I think early on, there was such a narrative coming from the companies that, you know, they're gonna help liberate people and connect people, and, you know, they're just there for that purpose. And, you know, they can help people speak freely when government censor them, and kind of this heroic role that they're playing. And I think we didn't fully comprehend the dangers of their business model, the pervasive data collection, the way that that's now, I think, really contributing to the disinformation and misinformation problem, and in some countries leading to offline harm. And I think none of us fully understood the extent that they were doing that, and they escaped regulation for so many years, and now they're so dominant that it's really hard as an afterthought to figure out how to break that up and how to push for more rights-respecting policies.
And what do you think that the future of your field is? Where do you see it going? I mean, you know, hopefully it continues along the path, those two paths you've just outlined, but where else might it be going in the next, say, 5, 10, 20 years?
Another tough question. I think there's going to be more, hopefully, since the field is getting older now, there'll be more actual scholarship and kind of evidence-based research that will help us solve some of these problems. I say hopefully because, again, a lot of the data that we need to solve these tough problems is held by companies, and it's proprietary, but also there are data protection concerns with sharing it, so that is an actual problem. But I think there are good people who are actually a lot of people even from companies who are now in academic settings who are looking to solve these problems. So I think hopefully that's the direction this field will go, and that it'll continue to mature, and that there'll be more people working outside companies and outside government who can help solve these problems.
Yeah, very interesting. And I hope that, you know, also scholarship can be supportive in this space. My last question for you is really a key question, I think, for those who are in the audience who are thinking of a career in the space that you're in. So what's the most important piece of advice that you would give to a current student who wants to work in your field?
I think it's a few pieces of advice are getting, if you find someone whose work you find interesting, who's writing, if you read their paper or see them at an event, especially now that we're all online anyway, to follow up, to get to know them, to try to learn more. I think where I benefited from also was having a fellowship, and because I think fellowships are a great opportunity to explore ideas, to try something out without, it gives you the freedom of not being, you know, committed to the day-to-day of a job, but to be able to explore things more thoughtfully. And I think, also just learning new skills, and this is something I struggle with, is because the technology changes, and I don't have a background in computer science or in technology, but always try to surround myself by people who do and can ask them questions. And what I do want to do more of is actually trying to understand some of the more technical aspects just by trying to teach myself. But probably a piece of advice is, if that's interesting to you, to also look to see if you can get some more formal or informal training on some of the more technical dimensions of this field. But I think, yeah, always being open to learning more. And for me, I think also getting to learn from people in different contexts and environments. I'm very aware of how US-centric a lot of this space is, especially on digital rights. So for me, spending 5 years working with APC, understanding that there's different assumptions in the role of technology and different priorities in different parts of the world was really important.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Thank you.